Thank you, Mr. Tannert. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Good to be with you. Good to share this time with you. We just got back from El Paso in time to keep the night to be much observed. So we've been on the road. Bring you greetings from the El Paso brethren. And we had a very fine Passover in El Paso. Well, a new pope has been elected, and this new pope has chosen a name, Pope Francis. He's from the Jesuit order, and this is the order of the Catholic Church that is known for teaching quite a bit. And you might also realize, you probably do realize, that there are many Jesuit colleges in the United States, and usually the education by the Jesuits has been very good. And if you go to a school that is run by the Jesuits, generally you're going to, if you graduate, come out of there with a very good education. And so the event of the white puff of smoke going up as the alert that a new bishop or a new pope has been chosen usually causes some interest in the Church of God. I remember 35 years ago, when Pope John Paul II was elected, there was a great deal of speculation throughout his ministry, as at the beginning at least, as to whether he might fit in within some kind of prophetic paradigm. And retrospectively, as you look back, and most of you are old enough to look back to the time of the 1980s, you will admit that the world was shaped by the influence of three distinct individuals. Three figures were prominent on a world stage in the 1980s, and you might even say that they all three did a great deal of good. And they would be, in no particular order, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and Pope John Paul II. So did he fit into any prophetic paradigm? Well, it would be hard to say, except, well, maybe it's easy to say, and I'll mention that in just a little bit. Why were these individuals so prominent on the world scene, and what did they do that had such great influence over the world? Well, first of all, Ronald Reagan, because he stood up to the oppression of communism, and he reversed decades of a stalemate that began in 1946, just after the World War II, with the advent of the Cold War. And it was Churchill that proclaimed that right after World War II that an iron curtain had descended over Europe, a curtain which separated the East from West Europe. Margaret Thatcher was very similar to Ronald Reagan. She intervened. Some might say it was a very small thing at the very beginning of the time when she took over as prime minister by invading the Falkland Islands, which had been taken over, attempted to take over by Argentina. And I thought it was amazing at the time when we thought that the British Navy was basically dead. And in fact, the British Navy once ruled the world, but as the British Empire began to decline, interestingly, as often happens in a socialist state, as the British Navy began to get smaller and smaller in the 1800s and almost vanish, the bureaucracy with which it was governed grew bigger and bigger and bigger. As they had fewer ships, they had more bureaucrats to run a smaller navy. That's what happens with a social system. But she sent the British Navy to rescue the British subjects that lived in the Falkland Islands, and she retook that area, and I don't think there was hardly any bloodshed at all. They just invaded, got their island back, and then sailed back to Britain. But that was only the beginning. She also privatized many public entities that were run by the civil service and the social services in Britain, and she unleashed private enterprise. And when I got to England in 1972, there was no doubt that it was a socialist country. But she reversed much of that. Now, it's gone back and forth since that time with conservative and liberal governments, but she certainly had a mark on the world scene. And it was her partnership with Ronald Reagan that helped indeed bring down the Berlin Wall. I'll never forget a speech that I heard that she gave in Phoenix in a leadership conference in which she was positively lauding the United States and its rule of law and thanked us for our friendship to the British Isles. And she talked of her friendship with Ronald Reagan. And it was like a tear-jerking speech because it was very, very clear that there was a great deal of affection and like-mindedness between the two leaders. And certainly, looking back now over 35 years of history, Pope John Paul II will be remembered as the most traveled pope in history, and his influence on the world scene was immense. It was not until Pope Paul VI, actually in the 1960s, that the popes actually traveled much outside of the Vatican. It was an unheard-of thing. And Pope Paul VI made a famous trip, several famous trips outside of the Vatican, one to Fatima. But until his time, it wasn't customary for popes to travel at all. But Pope John Paul II was well-traveled for hundreds of years until the 20th century. The popes stayed basically within Vatican City, never emerging, just governing the Catholic Church from there. Together, these three leaders each had their own part in bringing down totalitarian regimes, along with Lech Walesa of Poland, that governed Eastern Europe, with Pope John Paul encouraging Europe at one time to, in a very famous speech, to rediscover her roots, and he meant that religiously speaking. And all the way to the time of President Reagan boldly calling on President Gorbachev to tear down this wall. It was an inspiring time in 1987. The time of the 80s was very inspiring. We know that the Bible shows that eventually there is going to be a united Europe, the one that is spoken of in the book of Revelation. And I dare say that without the pressure of Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and Pope John Paul II, a united Europe could not have been possible in the future, because a Europe divided by the Iron Curtain could never be united. So in their own small way, perhaps they laid the groundwork for Bible prophecy one day to be fulfilled. In the Middle Ages, there was an Irish monk by the name of Malky, and he said in 1139 that there would be 112 popes from his time that would reign until the last pope before God enters into judgment with the entire world. He received a vision when he was visiting Rome in 1139. Pope Benedict, the previous pope, was the 111th pope since Malachy's prediction, which was based on a vision that he received while he was visiting Rome and visiting the Vatican. So actually, some historians believe that his original prophecies included only 111 popes that would be until the time of the end and God's intervention in the affairs of mankind, and that the last one, whom he called Peter of Rome, that one was actually added to his writings. Well, however close to accurate his prophecies or his vision was, especially of the final 10 popes, each of them are given a serious name. You can look them up on the internet, but he had a name, and it's kind of like Nostradamus's prophecies in one sense. You know, it could apply to a lot of different things. I mean, like, this dangerous, sinister man will arise at some time in the future, and that could apply at almost any time in history, right? So that was Nostradamus' prophecies. A lot of people put a lot of stock in that or wonder about that. They don't know much about Bible prophecy, but they wonder about the veracity of some of these other, which I will call secular prophecies. But however close Malky's prophecies were, this Irish monk, especially of the final 10 popes, the selection of Pope Francis from the Jesuit order should put to rest any fear that this apparently very humble man will ever be the last pope. Which you might say, hey, wait a minute, this man could change while he's in office. Something could change in his ministry. He could go from being a man of the people, a man who takes public transportation, a man who likes to press the flesh. He could become a totalitarian leader all of a sudden at some point in the future. To which I would say, probably not. Probably what you're going to see from this pope is based on his background. He's going to be this kind of person. He's going to be a humble teacher for the rest of his ministry. That's my own opinion. And you, as listeners or people in an audience, should be able to separate opinion from fact. and from just a speculative point. So I will speculate and say, I don't think it's going to happen based on Bible prophecy. The subject of the papacy has always been one of great interest to all of us in the Church of God, and rightly so. Retrospectively, maybe now, it should have been very easy for us 35 years ago when Pope John Paul II was selected, that he would not be the last pope, and not based on the visions of the Irish monk either, but simply of the matter of fact that he was a different type of individual. It should be relatively easy, in my opinion, for us to see now that Pope Francis cannot be the final installment in this office based on Bible prophecy. Now, you might be wondering what all of this has to do with the days of unleavened bread, and I'm getting to that. But this is very, very important. This information is vital to us. And a matter of fact, it is mentioned many times within the Bible. The warnings of the Bible regarding the events have a great deal to do with your everyday lives, a great deal to do with your struggles with overcoming sin. And actually, the Bible gives us a very clear view of the events that will accompany the arrival on the world scene. If you want to say the last pope, that would be fine with me. But the Bible gives us a very clear picture. If at any time during the sermon you feel the hair in the back of your neck stand up, or you feel a little bit queasy, then so did I when I was preparing it. Welcome to the club. The days of unleavened bread is the time to take our calling very seriously. And sometimes the warnings of the Bible help us to evaluate our lives, our calling, our dedication to what God has given to us. I mentioned to the people at the Passover, we had a abbreviated crowd at Passover in El Paso. We only had 12, including Terry and I. There were some who could not make it. There are some who are sick. There are some who will take the second Passover. There are some who had medical issues and so on and so forth. We usually have had 16 or 17 there in past years. But I said, I want you to look around this room and look at everybody sitting here. And I'd encourage you to do the same thing here. Look around, and the hotel that we meet in for the services and for the Passover and most of our holy days in El Paso sits up a little bit above the freeway, Interstate 10. And when you walk outside, you can see some of the city lights, and then you can see all the way across into Mexico. It's just a very short few miles away, and you can see all the lights. And I said, if you ever begin to think that God doesn't care for you, just take a look around at how few people there are here. And then I want you to go outside and look at all of the lights and think about all of the millions of people that are surrounded, because there's 3 million people in Juarez and a couple of million in El Paso, and there's 12 people in this room that are taking the Passover. And there's probably 60 or less that are here in this room in a town of a million that are keeping the Holy Day, and also other people with other groups, we know that. These days teach us the clear difference between sin and righteousness. They illustrate our high calling to a different way of life. They show us the rescue that has happened in each of our individual lives. So if you're hearing the sound of my voice, then you know that you are a rare individual, not because of anything you've done, hasn't been something that you've earned. Even from the time that you've been in the church by now, you're not sitting here because of any other reason than God's graciousness. It's not because you've been obedient, although that helps, as Mr. Tanner was mentioning. But it's only because that God has given you a calling that has separated you from the rest of the world. And so you and I all have a responsibility to take these things very seriously. These are serious warnings that we are given in the Bible about sin and righteousness. The people of God have a righteousness quotient because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that separates us from the rest of mankind and will protect us from the times of sin that await the rest of the world in the distant future or not too distant future. If you'll turn to 1 Thessalonians in chapter 5, we'll begin there. But Paul wrote two letters to the church at Thessalonica, as you know. He covered three basic problems in these two letters. There was a lot of subject matter in it, but there were three major things that he was addressing. And you can turn back to these chapters or to these books in case you ever find that, you know, your life is maybe in some of the kind of disarray that some of these individuals were in. He covered three basic problems. they were encountering some persecution as a result of their faith, and he wrote to comfort them during that time. His message was one of comfort. Secondly, there were some in the church at Thessalonica who were actually becoming insubordinate, disobedient, maybe even lazy, a number of different problems, but they weren't being diligent themselves. And three, he had to eliminate some confusion as to what would surround the events of the end time. And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 1, he said, "But concerning the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We're not of the night nor of darkness." Paul is using imagery here to show that because we are people who keep the commandments of God and because we treasure those things, we are sons of the day. And the Bible says a lot about those things. That means that we believe in righteous doing. It's not that that saves us or that that will preserve us or anything else, but it will help us to stay alert and aware. And so as people who are keepers of the commandments, we are sons of day, sons and daughters of the day and of light. We're not of the night and of darkness, as the rest of the world is going to be thrust into in the future. Having put sin out of our lives and having an eternal sacrifice to cover our sins, we should be indeed alert as to the events of the day and the understanding of them as well. So then he continues, "Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night. Those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation." Paul talks several times, doesn't he, here and in Ephesians, about the spiritual armament of a Christian and the responsibility to put that on a daily basis. "For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ." That is your goal. That is my goal. That is our collective goal. That is what we have been entrusted to. Remember, you walk outside of here, and if you're traveling outside and you see the big city of Tucson, it's a sprawling area, there are only a few people that have this knowledge, that God has allowed them to have it and has entrusted it to them. Verse 10, "Who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are also doing." So this is a warning to all of us. But Paul did write two letters. He wrote another letter to follow up what he had written before. And he wrote this letter because, as sometimes happens, people can get confused. And in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and in verse 2, he wrote, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask that you not be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means." Now, he had just covered this in the first letter. There are months that transpired in the meantime, but in the first letter in chapter 4, as it is written for us, it is cataloged for us, he gave a thumbnail sketch of what is going to happen with the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of the dead and all of the events surrounding the time of Christ's return. But now he heard reports that they had been shaken, that they had been disturbed somewhat. And you know, the same thing in my history in the church has been true sometimes of people in the church of God. They've been troubled. They've been shaken because they've been misinformed. They've been misled. Unfortunately, it happens at any time. It does happen. And, you know, people run the gamut from how they're going to react to being troubled or shaken or confused. Sometimes they can get angry. Sometimes they can get discouraged. Sometimes they can think, oh, you know, this is nothing but some stupid church of man, and they can fall away as a result. We are to be the guardians of our minds, and we are to be the guardians of our faith individually, and we in the ministry, that is our job to do so collectively. and to warn when necessary. But apparently at this time, someone had circulated information, probably it was a letter purporting to be from Paul, that was a game changer. Wait a minute, this is changing everything. This is contradicting everything. We don't know what the contents of that letter are. Well, only we can speculate that someone sent a letter. Guys, wait a minute, I've changed my mind. It's not going to happen like this. It's going to happen in a different way. And I think that Christ has already returned, because that is the essence of their confusion. They had been confused as to the fact that Christ had already returned. They had been told in the first letter that the dead in Christ were going to rise first, and then those who were alive and remaining. And someone had gotten to them with some false information. That has happened in the four generations, or four decades, rather, that I have been in the Church of God as well. Not as a letter from Paul, but just the confusion that comes along with lies and people purportedly telling the truth. Paul continues and says that the day will not come unless the falling away comes first. Now, you might ask at this juncture, has that falling away occurred in the Church of God? To which I can answer dogmatically, I don't know. I don't know. It would seem that way in some ways, but the end of the story hasn't been written yet, and we may not know it until later on. But, I mean, when you take a look at this small group and realize that 25 years ago, we would have filled this room and probably had to back out those walls with the people from Tucson and Sierra Vista. And even if you brought back all of the people of God under one roof, all of the people who believe exactly like we do, but for whatever reason they're in some other group, they would still not fill this entire room, those in this particular geography I'm speaking of. He said that day will not come unless a falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Who is this mysterious man of sin? And how will we know when he's revealed? The man of sin has not yet been revealed in the flesh. He's revealed in the Bible. He is revealed for us in the Bible, but he hasn't yet appeared on the scene. I have some personal ideas as to how that might happen. It's an opinion. It is clearly speculation, and it should be labeled as such. And I'll share that with you before we finish today. But the revelation of the Bible is very clear as to what this individual is going to do, how he will do it, and for you, you should have no doubt or question when these things happen. In other words, you won't have to wonder or speculate or be puzzled. The same thing that Paul told the Thessalonians is, you won't need to be shaken or confused as to the events. So you should leave here today with a very clear path and a clear understanding. And if you had it before, good for you. You probably should have had it before. But you should not be confused in the future if you internalize this information from the Bible. Now, when you read through the description of this man of sin, according to Paul, it leaves very little to the imagination. Number one, he is the son of perdition. He is the son of hell. In other words, he is the son of destruction and damnation. That's what perdition means. Two, he opposes and exalts himself above God, or all that is worshipped as God. And three, he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself as God. What he does will be astounding on the world scene. He won't be a quiet Jesuit humble priest who has been living in an apartment in Argentina someplace for the last 30 years of his life, getting on public transportation and teaching people. He will not be that kind of individual. Sure, thousands throng around Vatican Square in the rain. They await the announcement of a new pontiff. But this revelation is going to dwarf any others into insignificance. And I'll show you why. Second Thessalonians chapter 2. Second Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 5. Paul said, "Do you not remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? Why should somebody deceive you now? Why should somebody confuse you, shake you, bring you to some other kind of understanding? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who is now restraining will do so until he is taken out of the way." Now, what does all of that mean? There is a power that Paul is speaking of here, a power that has been restrained, a power that is restrained from being unleashed on the earth. He also speaks about this same power in Ephesians 2 and Ephesians 6, the prince of the power of the air and spiritual wickedness in high places. In other words, God has not allowed that power to be unleashed on mankind yet. That man, that power that accompanies this man of sin is going to be restrained until the time of his revelation. That power has not had free reign on the earth. Sure, we call it the world of, it's not God's world, it's Satan's world. We realize that at the Garden of Eden, as Mr. Armstrong so aptly put it, God had a hands-off philosophy. There was the serpent in the garden, and it's been his influence that it's held sway over mankind since that time. But it hasn't been totally, utter dominant, or else God would never be able to call anybody out of this world. So he's called people along the way, but that power has been held in check, so to speak, and it will be held in check until the time of the revelation of this man of sin. From the New Testament, a new translation by Olaf Nori, verse 7 is translated this way: "But evil work is held in check and will be held back until the time when he who now restrains will be set aside." Verse 8 says, "And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one, who is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders." As an aside, God's people should be so well educated that they would never allow stupid, dumb ideas to infiltrate their thinking. And a stupid, dumb idea that began to be circulated in the late 80s and the early 90s was that this particular prophecy had to do with the true church of God, and that there was somebody that was sitting within that temple, the church of God, and was the embodiment of this individual. Shame on those people who came up with such a cockamamie, stupid idea. And I'm just going to label it for what it was. Cockamamie, stupid prattle. We should know better than that. We should know better that Joe Tkach did not become the man of sin, because there are other prophecies that help us to show that. I don't know if you people heard that here. I don't know if you did, but some people did. Some people postulated this theory. It's dumb, it's biblically illiterate, and it has nothing to do with this particular prophecy at the end time, because certainly the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all powers, signs, and lying wonders. What lying wonders, signs, miracles occurred during the ministry after Mr. Armstrong had died? Well, there was lies. Sure there was. There were lies within the church. There weren't any miracles. There weren't any spiritual miracles and lying wonders and that sort of thing. So remember, after today, if you hadn't before, you should certainly leave here with a very clear path and understanding of what the truth is concerning the man of sin, because you're not of the dark. You're of the light. You should understand these things. If you're in this room, you should understand this. So that was speculation by people who, in my view, should have known better. This prophecy was not been fulfilled before. We haven't seen anything like this. Verse 10 goes on, "With all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved." That is according to God's plan. Matthew 13 tells us that. Matthew 13 shows us that Christ spoke to parables so people would purposely misunderstand, so they wouldn't understand the truth, so they wouldn't be held accountable for disobeying it once it came to their consciousness, because it wasn't their time to be called. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, which won't be hard because the world is delusional anyway. This church entity has perpetuated delusions for almost 2,000 years now. And so the delusions of Easter and Christmas and all of the other things surrounding what it does has all been delusional. And so you accompany that with lying power and miraculous ability and the power of Satan behind it, and you're going to find it's pretty easy for people to follow after it. Now, Paul says that when he was with them, he told these things to them anyway. He asked them, "Don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you these things?" We could apply the same thing to our own lives today. We have all been in the church long enough to say to ourselves, we shouldn't be falling for any dumb things. Now, if something is really crafty, then, you know, particularly pernicious and close to the truth and yet it's off, maybe you would say that person might have an excuse in some ways. But if something is just blatantly off the wall, then you shouldn't believe it. You should be prepared to refute it. Now the question is, Paul conveyed this information to them. And he outlined to them very clearly, a very clear path as to what was going to happen and how the man of sin would come on the scene and what they should be aware of, and that there would be a falling away first. Where did Paul get his information about the man of sin? Well, it's true that Paul was taught by Christ for 3.5 years in Arabia. The book of Galatians tells us that, helps us to see that he received instruction. But the essence of what Paul gave them had already been recorded in the canon of the Old Testament. If you'll turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 9, first of all, we'll skip around some of the book of Daniel today. There's a prophecy that is so exact, and so it's very complex, and so we don't really have time to go over it in its entirety today. In fact, I'm not going to even cover it, but it's called the 70 weeks prophecy, and the last week, 69th week, shows that Christ would be cut off in the middle of the week, and then the resumption of his ministry would occur later on, after 2,000 years. But in verse 25, actually we'll begin in verse 26, after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be, sorry, I said 69, I meant 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood until the end of war desolations are determined. Very briefly, the people of the prince are going to be the people that follow this particular prince, this particular man of sin that is going to be revealed in due time. Not today, probably not next week. Probably there are so many things that have to happen prophetically that will outline, you know, you've outlined many, many times before. But there are several things that are happening prophetically here. We won't go all of them, but the essence is that the city, and by that we mean, or the Bible means Jerusalem and the sanctuary, are going to be destroyed. History repeats itself. Daniel 8 also shows a glimpse of this man in verse 11. Daniel 8 and verse 11. Let's go down actually to, verse 8, you know. Yep. Chapter 8 and in verse 8, it says, "Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken in its place. Four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. and it grew up in the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars of the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all of this and prospered. Again, this is an indication that there is going to be this important man of sin that will appear on the scene in the future. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation and the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said, "For 2,300 days." Another very interesting prophecy, the 2,300 days prophecy, that we won't go into today. It's complex. It would take, you know, a half hour to explain the essence of it. You've probably read it before and you understand it to some degree. Maybe a refresher sometime in the future will be good, but it refers to the morning and evening sacrifices, and so it's, you know, you cut that number 2,300 in half. But the main thing is there is going to come a time, and it seems to be very, very clear. If you'll turn to Daniel 11, and in verse 31, this is a prophecy that was first, well, it was first and only, it's only referring to this one time. This prophecy occurred historically in 168 B.C. It says, "Forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place the abomination of desolation." Now, that happened during the time of the Maccabean revolt. Herodotus records the event, corroborates what Daniel was inspired to say. It happened in 168 B.C. It's a well-known historical event that the temple was ransacked by Antiochus Epiphanes, who is one of the generals of the four groups that came out of the Grecian Empire, and he came into the temple of God and placed in it a statue of Jupiter. And some say that that statue is still in existence even up into the 1960s and occupied a place in a famous cathedral. But he placed this statue of the god Jupiter there and then apparently offered pig sacrifices in the temple. That is what tradition, that is what Josephus, that is what all historical accounts reference. And that particular part of the prophecy has been fulfilled. But it's a forerunner of what is going to happen in the future and what the coming beast power will do along with this man of sin or the false prophet, as he could also be called. In verse 32, it says, "Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." Now hold your place in the book of Daniel, and I'll ask you to turn to Luke chapter 21. Because Christ said that this particular prophecy or this particular historical event would occur once again, and he prophesied of this almost exact same thing happening that happened 172 years before his birth. It happened in 168 B.C. Christ prophesied that this almost replication of this historical event now in his lifetime would happen. The prophetic event that happened in Daniel was a historical event in Christ's lifetime because it already had happened. But in Luke 21 and verse 20, it says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, interestingly, Christ spoke in prophetic terminology, but his prophecy was dual, because the first time that this particular prophecy was fulfilled happened in 66 A.D. Well, actually 66 A.D. to 70 A.D. The Romans, under the command of a general by the name of Cestius, marched on Jerusalem in 66 A.D. And when they got to the gates of the wall of Jerusalem, suddenly they stopped. And the people who were in Jerusalem, who saw the Roman armies come to conquer them, were obviously very afraid. Christ's prophecy was a prophecy of that particular time in 66 AD. The church was in Jerusalem. There were people of God that were in Jerusalem at that particular time. And they fled. And they got out of Jerusalem and they escaped to Jordan and they migrated elsewhere. 4 years before the Romans returned and took over Jerusalem and razed it to the ground, destroying the temple and everything in it, and apparently killing 1 million Jews at that particular time. So it was a type of the fulfillment of what is going to happen in the time of the end. And there were people who were in the church who heeded Jesus' warning of 30 years more previous that fled at that particular time. The prophecies of Daniel and the gospel accounts make it clear that daily sacrifices of some kind, as illogical as that may sound to us now, and as difficult as it is for us to wrap our minds around there being some kind of modern temple in Jerusalem, when that area is controlled by the Palestinians now, that area is controlled not by Jerusalem, that area where the first temple was built. There's a Dome of the Rock. There's a mosque there at that particular time, at this particular time, and has been for many years. As difficult as it is for us to wrap our heads around how that could conceivably happen, still it appears from the many prophecies that it indeed will happen, and it's not going to be simply a matter of prayers being the sacrifices of people. It appears as though there will be daily sacrifices, morning and evening, that will be reinstituted in Jerusalem at some point. So it shows that there is going to have to be some particular reason for that happening, and that that is going to be aborted. That is going to be something that is terminated by the beast power and by the man of sin. The beast power is going to cause the daily sacrifices to cease, and the man of sin is then going to place himself right in that temple, just as Antiochus Epiphanes did as a pagan leader, and he's going to proclaim himself to be God. Notice Daniel chapter 12 and in verse 9. Michael, the archangel, gave this vision to Daniel, and he said to him, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end." Very encouragingly, it says, "Many shall be purified, made white, and refined." During that period of time, and evidently pointing to the time of the Great Tribulation, and Revelation also tells us that there will be an innumerable multitude that come out of the Great Tribulation in white robes, they will be refined. "But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days," which apparently is around the time of Christ's return. That would seem to be the reason for the blessing to be pronounced 45 days prior to the abomination of desolation being set up. So apparently there, you know, we don't know the time and the day of Christ's return, but apparently there is this kind of internal warning system for all of God's people to be aware of what is happening. But it's not really going to matter about days or counting days or anything like that if you're spiritually not attuned to the situation. Because the wise are going to understand, but the wicked are going to continue to do wickedly. God has thought of you at this particular time that you are now in a position to take action in your own life. You are now in a position to put sin out of your life and to begin to practice righteousness in your life, therefore obeying the days that we're in the midst of keeping, or that we're now in the very beginning of keeping. And Daniel concludes his prophecy, or is encouraged to conclude his prophecy, by the archangel Michael, and again it mentions these daily sacrifices. Revelation 13, obviously you're way ahead of me on this, also describes this time and mirrors what Paul said about this particular individual, the man of sin, who will be revealed in due time. Not now. Very possibly alive today, but not in this particular office. We would be in very, very different situations that were that the case right now. So thankfully we've got advance warning. We know that Revelation 13 describes the beast power rising up, out as it were out of the Mediterranean Sea, and having 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 horns. Verse 3 describes this. We've heard it for many, many times. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. The world is not marveling and following Europe at this time. Europe is maybe not in crisis mode, but it's at the step, it's at the doorstep of crisis and problems, financial. There isn't any system that has been, whether it's been a democratic social state or whether it's been just a socialized social state, that has ever existed or ever perpetuated itself. As Margaret Thatcher said, socialism is a really good idea until you run out of other people's money. Because someday, and it's immoral too, it's absolutely immoral to redistribute wealth that people have earned and give it to somebody that hasn't earned it. It's not in the Bible. It's certainly not something that the Bible endorses in any shape or fashion. It's hideous. And Europe has been moseying along now for many, many years. It's come together at certain in certain unified states, but it's not one. And it'll probably take a huge crisis. It may be an economic crisis that begins the unification in reality of Europe. But they're not unified now, but there have been much of the groundwork has been laid. But crisis is perhaps the greatest instigator of unification that there can be, if they have to come together. But we're not speaking particularly about the beast power today. We're speaking about the man of sin. And this individual is also mentioned in this particular chapter in verse 11. He says, "Then I saw another beast." Now, we know that beast is a synonym in the Bible for government. And so here's another government that comes out of the earth. They're called horns in the book of Daniel, and we'll go back to that in just a bit. "But I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." This is that individual that Paul referred to. Looks like a lamb. What is a lamb a synonym for? Jesus. But he had horns. He speaks like the devil, like Satan. "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast," pardon me, "telling them who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." So it's going to have real power. Now, popes, anciently speaking, had power. The popes of old had armies that they commanded. They went out to battle and they commanded armies. And that's going to happen in the future as well with this kind of power, that is. This individual's sole activity in his ministry, so to speak, is going to persuade the people of the world to worship the beast, to worship that unificated power that is going to come together in Europe. And in so doing, he's going to perform great signs, and he's going to have power to bring fire down from heaven, so he's going to have the ability to kill people if necessary. The influence of this man of sin cannot be underestimated. We'll come back to Revelation, but notice 1 Timothy chapter 4, maybe in a way that you hadn't thought of it in a sense before. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1. Paul writes, he's not quoting anything here, so this must have been a inspiration of God's Holy Spirit. Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith. Now, that means that between now and the time of Christ's return, just to shorten it up a bit, between right now, I mean, because we're living in the present, right? Between this time now, when people like you and I know the truth, up until the time of the end, the future, that some people are going to depart from the faith. I mean, because we know that people have departed from the faith in the past. But why will they depart from the faith in the future? Because they will give heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. That power is the power that is wielded by this man of sin. Because as easy as, you know, some people have been deceived in the past, in our history and in our knowledge and understanding of them, they certainly haven't been deceived by a supernatural power of deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. Not necessarily. I mean, you know, there just hasn't been that kind of power that is wielded by it. And Paul says that it's in the last times that people are going to depart from the faith. So you know what that means? That means it could include you and me. We could be in this category that could be deceived. He goes on, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Paul also said that the mystery of this lawlessness was already at work. It was at work in his day. It had already begun. There were false religions, and there was masquerading Christianity in the 60s AD. And it was something that all of the apostles faced during their ministry 30, 40 years after the time of the establishment of the Church of God. But so powerful will the deception be in the end time that even those who have known the truth will depart from it and believe lies, such as the tradition that priests should take a vow of celibacy. Well, that's what it means, doesn't it? It sounds incredible. Yet someone, if they left the truth of God and went back to the Catholic Church, then they'd be endorsing that. Do you know any Catholics that have come out of Catholicism and have come to the Church of God? Sure, I think we all do. And you know what? I've known some people who have gone back to the Catholic Church. That is a lie. You know, forbidding to marry is a tradition of the ministry of the Catholic Church, but it's a lie. And if you went back to the Catholic Church having been deceived by doctrines and spirits and been amazed and awed by the power that accompanies the man of sin, then you would be endorsing that. Incredible as it seems, that is very likely something that could happen. Now in Revelation 16, we see this one individual once again in verse 13. Revelation 16 and verse 13. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And therein again is the reference to the days in which we're keeping this week, the days of unleavened bread. Unleavened bread pictures righteousness. The garments that are clean picture righteous living. That is what we have been called to, and that is where a blessing is pronounced. Now, you didn't earn anything. You didn't earn salvation by your righteousness. You didn't earn your calling by your righteousness or anything else, but make no doubt about it. Righteous living is expected of us once we have been called to the truth. And that is what we have to do during this week, is to search our lives, to search areas in which there may still be leaven and get it out. That is the purpose for this particular time. Revelation 17 describes the concordat of the church and the state. And I'll not spend any time on this chapter right now, but I'll come back to it as my plan, God willing, the next sermon that I give, which is entitled The Characteristics of the Beast Power. But verse 16 shows a very interesting prophecy, and there may be a secular counterpart. In verse 16 it says, in chapter 17, the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot. The harlot is the synonym for church that is described in the beginning of the chapter. Make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. That's a very interesting thing that is going to happen at the time of the end as well, that church is going to be destroyed by this particular beast power. We see that in prophecy. There was a vision that Pope Pius X had in 1909. This pope had a number of prophetic visions. In the midst of an audience with members of the Franciscan order of which he was a part, he fell into a trance. Moments passed, then his eyes sprung open and he jumped to his feet. He exclaimed, "What I have seen is terrifying. Will I be the one or will it be a successor? What is certain is that the Pope will leave Rome, and in leaving the Vatican, he will have to pass over the dead bodies of his priests." Now, the source says it's uncertain what the vision alluded to, but it's similar in many respects to the reported third prophecy of Fatima. Shortly before his death, another vision came to him, and he said, "I have seen one of my successors of the same name who was fleeing over the bodies of his brethren." So take it for what it's worth. Interesting Catholic speculation, an interesting coincidence. Or maybe a vision inspired by a demon. Mr. Tannert stole this scripture from me earlier, but it's in James 2 and verse 19. Certainly, they could have inspired something with a pope. James 2 and verse 19, "You believe there is one God, you do well, even the demons believe and tremble." I believe they tremble because they know their ultimate fate is destruction, but that's just a personal opinion. Daniel 7 was certainly one of the chapters that Paul was utilizing to instruct the people of Thessalonica about the man of sin. So I'll ask you to turn to Daniel chapter 7, another interesting prophecy, and we begin in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel had a dream and the visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, pardon me, arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird, The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terribly exceedingly strong. It had huge teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. And it was different from all the feasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. This is the beast that obviously, you know, is described of in Revelation 13, the one and the same, the resurrection, 7 of them of the Holy Roman Empire through history. Probably all at one time had taped in the back of your Bibles a little beast chart showing all the various rulers, Justinian the Great, and all of the other reincarnations of the Holy Roman Empire. You've probably seen that. You probably had a Bible at one time. You got yellow with wear because you looked at it and referred to it so many times. But then he mentions that I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom the first 3 horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. And I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and his hair, the hair of his head, was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued, and he came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, the books were opened, and I watched then because the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. This is that same horn of Revelation, the little horn that pops up, the other beast. This is the man of sin and this is the information that Paul had gleaned and was teaching to the people of Thessalonica. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So Daniel, of course, we know, had a vision of 4 world-ruling empires, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then this man of sin is mentioned. In verse 20 it says, the 10 horns which were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which the 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. And if you have that old beast chart somewhere, you'll know that the Vandals, Heruli, and the Ostrogoths were 3 powers who were slain. They were parts of that attacked the Roman Empire, to which the Pope at that particular time was able to help the Roman Empire prevail as a result. A forerunner of what will happen in the future. I was watching, and the same horn was making war with the saints and prevailing against them. A very disturbing aspect of prophecy. That this horn has prevailed historically against the saints at different times. Covered in the book of Revelation, in some manner, in chapters 2 and 3, when it talks about the times of the Church of God down through history. The Church of God and the truth of God has come into conflict with this powerful church down through history. The church has been obscure. The church has been small. We won't go into the history of it at this particular time. But figuring prominently with the man of sin is apparently some of God's people throughout history and in the time of the end. Now, we can go on down a little bit further. It says that the 10 horns, verse 24, 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones. He shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High and shall persecute the saints of the Most High and shall intend to change times and the law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times and half a time, or 3.5 years. Apparently, the Great Tribulation. Unfortunate. We don't know when that time is going to begin, but we know that Revelation 12, for instance, promises that God's people can be protected during that time as well. The angel describes these beasts, describes who they are, their powers, their governments. In verses 17, he says, these great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. And so they were. Verse 18 says, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So I'll refer you back to what I told the brethren in El Paso. You can walk out this door, you can take a look at the millions that surround you in society, and you can say, there but for the grace of God go I, because it applies to every single one of us. What you do with the days of unleavened bread and your part in putting out sin and receiving righteousness, receiving the gift of God's graciousness into your lives is something that is between you and your Creator. And I encourage you to do that throughout this time and to be sobered by the prophecies, which, you know, maybe 5, 10, 15, or 20 years in the future, but they are sure and they are going to happen. And you know it down to the very deepest point of your soul. You understand that it's going to happen. And your salvation isn't predicated on hanging on till the end and just somehow by your fingertips. Your salvation is based on God's graciousness, but certainly you have a part in your calling in putting sin out continually, putting the leaven out as you find it, understanding that we're all responsible for that, and we have a responsibility that God has given to us. Now, how will this man of sin be revealed? I'll close on my hunch. My hunch is that it's going to be with the normal puff of white smoke, and it could happen sometime in a future Easter celebration. That's a guess. And if you're going to guess, you may as well just swing for the fences. And the reason I say that is this. There is so much about that particular celebration that is such a falsehood, and yet it enamors so many people. And I'm not going to base my salvation on it, and I'm not going to look for Easter to Easter to see it happen. Let's just put it this way. I wouldn't be a bit surprised that the normal election of cardinals, bishops, whatever, will take place, and someday the man of sin is going to be revealed in a very normal way. But after that, nothing will ever be normal again in this world. Nothing. Because all of the power and the might, the deception and the lying wonders of the devil are going to be turned loose on the world then. It hasn't happened yet. And it would be my firm belief, and you don't hang your hat on this either, that it's not going to fall into the hands of Pope Francis. Not going to happen. It'll be of someone much different. Brethren, may God bless his people and continue to grant them redemption and forgiveness until that day.